Welcome to the Punk Rock MBA Podcast.
What's up, everybody? I'm Finn McKenty. This is the Punk Rock MBA Podcast. Very excited to welcome Johnny Frank to the show. Johnny is the brains behind Bill Murray, B-I-L-M-U-R-I. Sounds like the actor, but spelled differently. He has another project called The March Ahead. He's been a producer for maybe 10 years or something like that. And you may also know him as the kid with the afro that did clean vocals and played guitar in Attack Attack back in the day. So I wanted to have him on for a few reasons. First of all, I'm a big fan of his music. I love all the projects, like pretty much everything he's ever been involved with, I like. But beyond that, what I wanted to talk about was two things. First of all, he is one of the most insanely prolific people that I have ever encountered. I think over the past 4 years between those two projects, he's released something like 10 or 11 albums, like well over 100 songs. And this is all like good stuff. This is not like Viper or something where he's putting out 1,000 mixtapes a year, but it's all garbage. Johnny's one of these rare breeds that's able to produce a huge volume of really high quality work. I find that super inspiring, so I wanted to sit down and talk to him about exactly how he does that, like figure out how he's wired. Second thing I wanted to do is talk about the business side of things, because he has been able, in the past, I think maybe about a year ago, he made Bill Murray his exclusive full-time job, and he's doing it all DIYs. Basically, just out of his home studio in Columbus, no manager, no label, no booking agent, no none of that stuff. They barely even tour. Just to me, this is the model for what an independent creator looks like in 2020. So I wanted to sit down with him and talk about how he runs things from the business side as well. So yeah, super excited to have Johnny on the show, and let's get into it. Johnny, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for making time for this. I know you got a lot of stuff going on, so I appreciate it. I'm really excited to be talking to you.
Yeah, man, I'm excited to be here.
You are on the eve of the release of your next album, album number 27, Rich Sips.
Yeah, it's album number 9, but if it, I feel like 9 can feel like 27 sometimes.
Well, that's album number 9 from Bill Murray.
Yeah, that's true. There's other albums.
And you got another 3 or 4 or something from your other bands.
Yeah, it's up there for sure. But yeah, album number 9 in 3 years or 4 years now. 16 to 19.
Like I mentioned earlier, what I really wanted to focus on was just like how you have been able to make a living off of your music without doing a lot of things that people think you need to do. And I mean, let's just jump right into it. Like the fact that you're so insanely prolific, I don't know that that's necessarily realistic for everybody, because you're kind of a freak outlier, I think, but there's still something to be learned there. Like how do you just release so much shit?
I mean, it's really what I do to kind of stay sane. Like, you know, I know that you do jujitsu and stuff like that. It makes you feel like, all right, you know, life's, it's going to be all right. That's what music does for me. So if I'm not doing it, I feel like a huge piece of shit, kind of just like, what am I doing with my life? So the second I finish a record, I'm starting the next record immediately, like within a week, within probably less than a week. So there's that. I mean, I get bored really easily too. So my natural inclination is to just write music when I'm bored. But yeah, I mean, I just like love doing it. So I do it all the time. And I don't know, the way I also view it is it's basically like an adventure that you can have inside of your house, where every time you open up your DAW, you just don't know what's going to happen. You have no idea. You have no clue where you're going to be at or what's going to come out of it. And if you make something that's like truly great, it's just, I don't know, there's just not much that can match that feeling wise.
It's interesting that you would say that about doing that to stay sane, because that's kind of how I feel about everything that I do is, you know, I'm the opposite of most people. Like if I am not working, I get nervous and stressed out and
yep.
Like it makes me feel bad. You know, like for me, like relaxing is like, okay, I can get through this. I can go a day yes. and a half without working.
Dude, it sucks. It's so boring. Like I went on a vacation to the beach, and I like got a CrossFit membership at the beach because I was like, I need something to fucking do.
Yeah.
Cause like, I don't know, people, there's certain people who can just sit at a beach for like 7 hours and just hang out and do nothing. And I'm just not that person. I need something to create or something to be like building towards.
Yeah,
but I think
exactly.
Also, is your mind like pretty hyperactive?
Well, I don't know what other people's minds are like, so I can't compare it to anything, but probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's if I sit by myself, I feel like I'm driving myself nuts if I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say so, probably.
So I think, you know, for a lot of people who are listening, sometimes people ask me about being organized or productivity or motivation or something like that. And I used to tell them, oh, well, I use Evernote or whatever the fuck, you know, and then I realized, you know, it's not that at all. It's just the way I was born. And at least that's what I think. I think this is just the way some of us are wired to just be kind of wired to make shit all the time. And that's not, you know, better or worse than anybody. I think it's just the way we're naturally wired.
Yeah. I mean, there are times where I'm like, I wish I could sit on a beach for 7 hours and not like, and enjoy that.
For sure. Like,
it would be fantastic. I'm sure it's fun. I see plenty of other people doing it, but I will sit there for like an hour and just, I need to go work out. I need to do something that gets my blood pumping.
You can make it a whole hour? Wow.
It's hard. I mean, now with phones, it's a little easier, but even then I'm like, fuck, dude.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's the main reason that why I make so much music.
And have you ever had like a job other than music, like a full-time job?
No. Well, I mean, like when I was 15, I worked at Hollister.
Uh-huh.
for like 2 months.
At Polaris?
And then, yeah, dude. I worked in the back because I wasn't hot enough to go out front, but I worked there for 2 months and then I quit that. And then I worked at Panera for 1 month and I was like, this is bullshit. So I quit that. And I used my last paycheck to buy the auto tuner for Attack Attack.
Nice. And you were like, what, 17 or something then? 16?
16, yeah. 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 But other than that, that's all I've had.
And you're 28 now, 29?
29.
So you've been doing music full time for 13 years.
That's actually crazy. I haven't thought about that.
It's a long time.
That's a long time. Yeah. That's very long. Damn. That's cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. And for anybody who doesn't know, so you do everything in Bill Murray yourself, right? Like you write and play and record and mix everything, right?
I think for all the records up until this one, yeah. But this one's the first one where I really started opening it up to other people. So I did a couple co-writes on this record. And then I had my buddy Will mix this record. But before that, yeah, it was all... I mean, especially before the band had any sort of momentum. It's like, hey, do you want to work on a Bill Murray song? And everyone's like, fuck, who the fuck is that? I don't care. But now it's like, it carries a little bit more weight with it. So people are like, oh yeah, for sure. But yeah, so up until this record, I've done most everything. I always have people collaborate though. You know, like the saxophone solo on the last record is you know, my buddy. So, I mean, there's always been small levels of collaboration, but I'd say 90% of what it is just me.
So I guess where I'm headed with that is, like you said, now you're collaborating with people and stuff, but that's by choice because you think it'll be a cool, creative, you know, kind of tool rather than a lot of people where I think they are afraid or I don't know. I love the idea of being sort of the one-man band that you are alone on an island by yourself and you do everything, not just the music, but you also make a lot of videos and kind of random content. So you like... write it, you produce it, you create, you market it, like you do everything. And that to me is the essence of what I am about.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, most of the stuff I learned how to do because I was just so pissed off that I had to rely on other people to do it.
Yeah.
And also that other people couldn't understand what I was trying to get them to do. So like perfect example is I've shot a lot of Bill Murray music videos and edited a lot of Bill Murray music videos. But when we first started, I had tried like three different times with three different people, paid them money to do a music video and just it failed every time. So I was like, well, fuck this. I'm just going to do it myself. I'm going to sit on YouTube for 4 or 5 hours a day and just learn about video cameras or, you know, I don't know if they still call it DSLRs.
Yeah, right.
And I'm going to figure that out, figure about color grading. But it's basically, I don't want to be over-reliant and say it has to be me because at the end of the day, I just want to make dope shit. So if someone, you know, is way better than me at shooting music video and gets what I'm trying to go for, I'm like, absolutely. Or if someone is better at mixing than me and sees what I'm trying to do and does a better job, I'm like, yes. So I don't want my ego to get in the way of, like, will this song be better if this person is involved? If so, then they're going to be involved, you know, if they want to.
But you're never dependent on anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I learned producing. I produced full time for 8 years. I learned producing because I was so pissed off that I couldn't tell people, like, I would get an idea and I knew in my head it would be dope, but I'd try to explain. It's like, do, 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 you know, with my mouth or like that. I'd try to, it's like, this goes into like a breakdown here. And people would be like, oh, that idea sucks. I'm like, yeah, it kind of sucks the way I explained it, right. But the way I see it in my head is pretty cool. So I learned that because I was just angry, because I know this song is good if I just had a chance to show you what I'm thinking. So that's how I learned how to produce, is out of a just need to songwrite. I learned mixing out of just a need to learn how to do that to get where I wanted to be. But yeah, it definitely, you know, it took me a really long time to learn all those skills to be able to make Bill Murray. You know, that 7 years of producing full time, pretty much every day, I sucked for like the first 3 or 4 years. I was so bad. But, you know, it seems like Bill Murray came out of nowhere, but it is just a culmination of the past 7, 8, 9 years of learning those skills to be able to put it into something that is that music.
So you put out the first Bill Murray record, what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
January 2016.
So you had been doing music for almost a decade before you put out the first Bill Murray release.
Definitely, yeah.
That's a little wild. The 10-year overnight success, as they say.
Yeah, you learn a lot, you know, when you're sitting in your mom's basement recording death metal bands, you know?
Yeah. Well, what I love about that is just, you know, there's so many people that I talk to that are always saying, I can't do this, I can't do that, and this won't happen because this person won't. Like, just the idea that they're always looking for somebody to come along and give them permission or unlock some door for them instead of just going, well, fuck that. I'll just, like, open the door myself, and maybe it'll take me a year or two, but I'll just do it myself.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, but you also have to really love doing it, because if you don't, you're not going to eat that shit for 3, 4 years, you know?
Well, that's the other thing that I think is interesting, and I'm not that I'm trying to, like, criticize people, but just that I want to point out some of the thinking, and I've been guilty of all this stuff too. For people that say that they struggle with motivation, you know, that they love music, but they struggle with motivation to practice or write songs or whatever, and they go, well, maybe you don't love it as much as you think you do.
Yeah, you like the idea of it.
Yeah, but, like, you gotta love the work.
Yeah, it's like, you like the idea of you standing on a stage in front of 1,000 people. Do you like the idea of you playing shows to no one? Do you like the idea of, you know, sitting for hours on end trying to get this song right, and just all the stuff that goes into that one moment? It's thousands and thousands of hours to be able to get to that point, which is fine. I mean, like, some people are just like, hey, I want to strum a guitar on my off time. I'm like, that is dope. Like, whatever,
totally.
However music adds value to your life, do that. But if you'd say you want to make things happen, like, a lot of the times you just have to put the work in.
Yeah, I think a lot of times it comes down to that. And speaking of shows, it seems like you have been a little bit more active with touring this year, but I know before you said you don't really like playing shows that much, and so you have been primarily, I guess you would call it a studio project, but you haven't played a ton of shows with Bill Murray, right?
We've probably played a couple hundred, or probably 100 shows.
Okay, well, so that's a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, like, shitty house shows and...
You've never tried really to, like, be a serious touring band, and I'm sure you could. I mean, you know lots of people. You could be on a label. You could have a booking agent. You could have all of these things that other bands do, but you've chosen not to. Can you just kind of talk about that?
Yeah, well, I did the touring thing a couple years before that, and I just didn't like it. You know, I there's really hard to have like a relationship with someone when you're gone a lot. And I just didn't want to do that. I wanted to set roots down and go to the same coffee shop every day and work out every day. And it's really difficult to do that on tour. That being said, I love playing shows. You know, I think it's fun, but it's like finding the balance that doesn't topple my life over, my personal life, where, you know, a lot of these guys, not everyone, like some people are just built for touring.
Totally.
They can just do it. And props to them, because it is so difficult to do. But, you know, you see a lot of people who have a lot of struggles in their personal lives because they're out on the road. And that was definitely me. I was like, just, yeah, it was very difficult. So I stepped back and I was like, well, what do I want this band to be? What do I want the ratio to be of shows, writing, promoting, which is kind of, I feel like, the holy trinity of making music. But it definitely leans way more into my strength, which is producing and writing, than, like, I'm good at playing live shows and stuff like that, but that's not where what I love. It's like more of a dessert on the side that I can have every once in a while. But I do think, as you know, Bill Murray's fan base grows, I want to meet the people who help me live. Like, and we did a run on the East Coast recently, like a couple months ago, and it was one of the most rewarding experiences. Just be like, I mean, we would literally play a show and then just have drinks with people at the end of the night and talk until the show is over, and get to hang out with all these people who are listening to my music, and they would ask me questions, I'd ask them questions. It was just like such a human experience that was nice.
I mean, from looking at your social media posts, I mean, and I don't get the sense that you're a bullshitter.
Well, that's nice.
I think we're probably wired the same, which is like sometimes I wish I was better at faking it, but I'm just not.
Yeah.
And it seemed like you were just really, really enjoying that tour a lot. It seemed like you had a really good time playing those shows.
Well, there's an interesting thing that happens where it's like the first 5 days is so fun. But then like beyond a week, I hate it. I want to go home. I don't like have any energy left to give. The way I try to explain it to people is like if you went on a vacation to a cabin, like 1 week of that vacation is going to be dope. But if you're like, dude, I'm going for a month, I'd be like, that sounds like hell. That doesn't sound like a vacation. So the difference between a week and anything really above a week for touring is the difference between a month long vacation or, you know, whatever that is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I usually start to peter out around like 7 to 10 days. And you know, if I play a show, I want to be giving people everything I got. And if I don't have anything left, then it's going to be shitty.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people, that's the reason why I never tried to be in a serious band of any kind, is because I know I fucking hate traveling.
Yeah. Yeah.
I fucking despise it more than almost anything. And, you know, I would just be setting myself up for failure because I know I'd be miserable and people can tell. And I'd bum everyone else out that I was in the band with. And it's just, I just know myself well enough to just not even go there.
Yeah, I think, like, there's ways to make touring good. But, man, the amount of downtime is absurd.
I hate being out of my routine, like you said. Like, not being able to eat what I want because I'm pretty picky about my diet. I don't, you know, missing workouts, all that shit just drives me nuts real fast.
Dude, if I don't work out, man, I go down a spiral. So yeah, even on tour, I have to make sure I'm working out, but it's so difficult. I mean, I saw you post a couple weeks ago when you were at that URM.
Yeah.
That you're like, man, I'm trying to not eat like shit while I'm out and I'm trying to work out, but even it's still pretty hard.
And they were shitty workouts, you know, it wasn't, you know, I had to kind of rush through it, but at least it was better than nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about, I mean, to use an example kind of, you know, close to home for you, I remember when Mice and Men came out and they were immediately on the road, like fucking 9 months a year, 10 months a year, immediately.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I remember seeing a few bands around that time do that. And I was just like, well, shit, that's what it takes. Okay.
Yeah. And I think just things have changed so much. I do think before the internet, that is how you would do things. You're a walking advertisement. Now, the funny thing that I've realized is if you're on a record label, you're a walking advertisement for someone else who's making money out of you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, talk about that. You were tweeting about that the other day. Maybe you can talk about that idea a little bit.
Well, okay. I mean, like a basic record contract, they've like vary pretty drastically. But if you're thinking about it from a business, it's like, we're going to give you a loan and then we're going to take 80% of everything you make after that.
I mean, a label's a bank, basically, at the end of the day.
It's the worst bank ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A loan with the worst terms you've ever heard of.
There's no interest, but we make 80% of all your profits. It's like no business person would take that loan in any other situation.
Right.
Like, but for some reason, bands do. Now, it does scale. Like, that's the thing, is at what you were saying, is that the very tippy top, if you're making 20% of $50 million, then you're making good money. But I mean, that's just such a small fraction of what most bands make.
Well, I think most bands want to get signed not because they did the math and they said
clout chasers
or lazy. I think they do it not because they did the math and they're like, okay, this is a financially good decision on our part. Which if you have done that math and you think it makes sense, cool. But I think a lot of them are just like, well, we don't like marketing and we don't like, you know, they want a manager and an agent and all these people just because they don't like doing that part of it. And then they complain because they're not making any money. And it's like, well, yeah, because you have like 10 fucking people on your payroll, essentially. Like if you have a manager and a booking agent, like, yes, they're going to take some of your money because they work for you.
Yeah. And they, I mean, you are benefiting off of the people that they know. I mean,
that's how it works. Yeah. Like, yeah. If you want access to their network, you got to pay for it.
Yep. And that's the thing is, like, I don't hate record labels. I just don't think it works for most bands. It definitely works for, like, it worked for Attack Attack. Like, we sold a lot of records.
Rise had an amazing machine back then.
Yeah. And so I was like, no, you know, I don't want to spew anything out, but it's like, for that, most bands are not that, you know, which is fine. But it's like, if you want to make $30,000-$40,000 a year from your band, you can do that way easier independently than you can on a label. It's just a simple like matter of numbers. If you, all right, how many records would you have to sell at $10 a pop independently to make $40,000? I fucking suck at math, but...
Well, probably, I mean, it depends on your deal, but you're probably getting, what, maybe a dollar or $1.50 or something from that, plus you got to recoup, and who knows, and that's assuming the label even pays you, and it's entirely likely they won't.
Yeah, and if you do that, if you go the label route, and you're making 10%, for you to make $40,000, you have to sell a shit ton of records.
That's a lot of records.
But if you're making $7 a record, you don't have to sell that many to make $40,000.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective. The only podcast you crank up to 11.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
But first, I want to thank DistroKid for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. If you're not familiar, DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that musicians use to put their music into online stores and streaming services. So in plain language, if you have ever wondered how to get your music on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Deezer, Tidal, and many, many more, there's like dozens and dozens of different streaming services, DistroKid is the way to do it. It is super easy. I have used it to put my music on Spotify. It took me maybe 5 minutes to like set it up and upload everything. It's legitimately awesome. I am sincerely a fan of this company and their product. And for those of you who have asked, you can also upload your music to TikTok with DistroKid. And if you want a chance to get featured on DistroKid's Spotify playlists, you can do that by submitting a song through Spotlight and getting your fans to vote for you. You can also use Hyperfollow to get more Spotify followers. You can promote your new release as well as Spotify Canvas. That's where there's the video in the background in the player. And when you share it on Instagram, it shares that video too to make your Spotify release pop. And Spotify Canvas is available to all DistroKid artists. Like I said, as you can probably tell from this, like I am sincerely a fan of DistroKid. DistroKid can do everything I just talked about and so much more. So be sure to sign up with my link, which is in the show notes for this episode, to get 7% off your first year. That link is in the show notes of this episode, or go to distrokid.com/VIP/thepunkrockNBA. And thanks again to DistroKid for sponsoring this episode.
So I wanted to ask you specifically about Spotify, because I know, you know, lots of people complain about Spotify payments, and you know that has been documented a billion times. But if I'm correct, you make the majority of your income from Spotify. Is that right?
Yeah. I'd say 75%.
And you have what now, like 100,000+ monthly listeners?
I think it's close to 160,000 for Bill Murray. But I've also got the March Ahead, which hovers around 70,000, 80,000.
Okay, so call it 250,000 monthly listeners between all your projects at this point.
Yeah.
Which is a good amount, but it's not like crazy huge.
No, I mean, it's doable. Like, especially spread across multiple projects. It's not just all in one. The thing is like, if you release good music and music that people like and want to listen to, Spotify is going to push that out to as many people as they can.
Because that's what they want. They want people to listen to music.
They want people on their app. So if you make music that gets people on their app, they're going to be like, oh, okay, let's push it out. I mean, I think Spotify, in a lot of ways, is the best record label because, you know, they take 30%, which is fine, and then they promote the shit out of your music.
And they invested billions of dollars in building a technology platform.
Yes.
That you have access to with no upfront cost.
And you can upload as much as you want. Yeah, and have access to, what, 150 million users now?
That's how I feel about YouTube. You know, same thing. They built this amazing platform, and if you make videos that people like, they'll promote them. And, I mean, that's how I got, you know, 99% of the following I have is thanks to YouTube.
For sure. So I think, like, before the internet, touring had to happen. There's no other way to like reach people. Touring and the radio. What other, like, you're going to drop leaflets from a plane?
Or you could be like the Warped Tour Punishers handing out CDs in the parking lot.
Yeah. But I mean, even that's like,
but that's basically
era.
Touring. Yeah.
Yeah. So before the internet really took off, that was the way to do it. That's how you got your name out there. But now I actually think it's flipped. So I think you need to get your name out on the internet, and then once that's out enough, then you get people to come to shows.
Because why would somebody go see your band if they don't know who you are? And by the way, how valuable is it even to go out there and play to 8 people in Buffalo?
You're gonna waste your money
and like days and days of time. Like, what's the point?
And the time that you, like, if you buy a van, that's $5,000. That's an album. You know, that's 2 albums. Like, you going on tour, you get $1,000 of merch. That's a couple covers that you could put out. You get, you know, spend $1,000 on gas. Like, that's more, that's an advertising. You basically just did a year's worth of album cycles on that one tour.
And maybe you played to a few hundred people in total.
Yeah, ask any band. They all have horror stories. A few hundred people would be dope. I mean, most of the time those tours, it's like 5.
I mean 200 people over the course of the entire tour.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be, you know, incredible. But yeah, like most tours like young bands go on, they think they're like, oh, we're getting our name out there. Yeah. But it's like a single Facebook post is going to get your name out there more than this entire tour.
Exactly. That's how I think about it. It's like, if you do a really good job on Instagram, I mean, some of my posts, and I'm not like super famous or anything, some of mine will have like a reach of like 40,000. I hit 40,000 people with some post that took me 10 minutes to make.
Yeah, which I don't, you know, I don't blame bands for wanting to do the tour thing, because that's just the way it's been forever.
Especially if they enjoy it. That's a whole yeah. other, like, if you just like it and you're like, yeah, it doesn't make us money, but we like to do it. Cool, then do it.
We want to go out and get fucked up and play to 10 people a night, which, dude, I mean, if people like doing that, then hell yeah. Like,
sounds like torture to me.
But. Yeah, I mean, but we're, you know, introverts.
Yeah.
But like, I did post this one time and some guy was like, you know, I went out on tour with my band 10 years ago and I was with my best friends and it sucked and I'll remember it for the rest of my life. And I'm so glad it did. And I was like, that's fair. That's cool. I mean, I'm glad you had that experience. For me, if I did that, I would be in such a bad mental state and hate it so much. So anyways, the point I was making was, like, what I coach a lot of bands to do is build a fan base before you go out on tour. Because then you'll go out and it'll be a good experience. You know, for me, I'm like, if 50 people come out to the show, I'm gonna have a damn blast. And it'll be worthwhile. Even if 50 people come out, you'll make a decent amount of money. If you're doing more DIY stuff, like we made more on our DIY tour than we made on like our big tour. Just because the venues don't charge anything, they give you all the door and like, which is cool. So, I mean, if you can get 50 people out anywhere in the Midwest, say, like then you start touring, then you start building that thing. Cause then you get 50 people to come out and then they tell more people and that kind of thing happens. It spreads that way, but no one's going to tell someone about a show that they played where one person was there.
The other thing that I think is important for people to understand is that the reason why the economics of Spotify, and correct me if I'm saying anything wrong here, but the reason why the economics of Spotify work out so well for you is because you don't have a label involved, because you upload it all yourself, you get 100% of all that Spotify revenue, as opposed to having to take your pittance off the top from a label.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's like very interesting because you, if you're on a label, you get a small percentage of that and then you got to pay taxes. You know, it's just like you put all those things in, your manager takes 15%, taxes take 30%. Like you are getting maybe 1/100th of what you're actually bringing in. So,
but all those people, all those complainers, they signed up for that. Like when
yeah,
you signed
the contract,
if you didn't understand it, I'm sorry, but you signed it.
Yeah. And that, you know, honestly, like I remember I used to be kind of butthurt about that. Like we made them so much money. It's like, you know what, dude, like you signed the contract, you did all this stuff. And honestly, like I think Rise Records treated us pretty damn well. And I don't think we would have been anywhere near as successful as we were without them. So it's like, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, would you be here now without them? Maybe.
Fuck no.
Maybe
no.
Not, you know? I mean, they did a lot for you.
No, absolutely not. It's like, yeah, so there is that mindset where it's like, yeah, I could make myself the victim, but also a lot of good came out of that situation. And we, like, sold a lot of records, but we are also so fucking stupid with our money.
Well, because you're children.
Yeah, and that's why we, I mean, like, I don't want to paint it like we made no money. We just spent all the money that we made on dumb shit. Like, we're like, we want a full crew. We want a bus. We're going to pay everyone really well. And then it's like, well, dude, you know, if you do that, you don't get any money at the end. Like, so I think, like, a lot of that, you know, I like to take the mentality of, oh, what? It was probably my fault. What could I have done to make it better? So yeah, no shade on anyone, but yeah, I just think like if you want to be like a mid-tier band, you can make a lot of money independently.
I think what you're doing really reminds me a lot of how rappers operate these days.
It's so funny you said that. That's literally exactly who I modeled the entire business model of Bill Murray off of.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, tell me about that.
I just remember 2016, I think was around the time that rap just started absolutely destroying rock. I mean, it had been for a couple years, but that was where it just kicked off. I remember looking at Spotify top 50, because I always look at it, and it was all rap. There was not a rock song to be found. And so I was like, okay, cool. I mean, I was listening to rap all the time too.
I do too.
Yeah. So I just, they were putting out the interesting stuff. So I started looking at it like, okay, what do rappers do that rock artists don't do? They're always on social media. They promote the shit out of themselves on social media. They work hard on that. They put out 2-3 albums a year. They like are independent, and they get their beats from wherever. I mean, like, they just make it happen. They don't have any rules. They'll record wherever they can. I remember I was watching an interview of Noah 40, who produces for Drake. He was like, yeah, we recorded this song in a bathroom of a hotel. And I was like, that is the dopest shit.
Dude, I've heard that a million times from people that recorded huge artists on a fucking iPhone in a hotel room.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's like rebellious. It's like, fuck you, dude. I'm going to record this top 40 hit on an iPhone. I'm like, yes, dude. That's what I like.
Exactly. There's no rules.
Yeah. But the thing that I felt like too is rock is the Catholic Church. You know, it's established. There's all these rules. There's all these things you can and can't do. You can't sample. You can't, you know.
They get so butthurt about the most inconsequential things, like whether you use fucking amp sims or not.
Yeah, you can't have programmed drums.
Who fucking cares? Like, zero people listening care.
Yeah. How about I do my programmed drums and make way more music, you know, way quicker, way cheaper.
And it sounds fine.
It sounds better to me. Yeah. But yeah, so I looked at that, and I just like loved the promotion, the amount that they put out, and the DIY nature where they're just like, I'm just going to do whatever the fuck I want. I'm
yeah.
Like, yes. So I modeled Bill Murray entirely after that. I was like, that's what you need to do now to have this be successful and be dope.
There's a term that they talk about like with media companies a lot, which I like a lot, is that it's like the winners are a barbell-shaped distribution, meaning that if you're a really big company like Disney, you're doing great. Or if you are a really tiny company like, say, a YouTuber, you're doing great. But if you're in the middle, that's the squeeze, is all those kind of bloated, they're not big enough to be like the big dogs, but they're not small and nimble enough to be over here. They're just kind of in that bloated middle, and that's where they're getting squeezed. And I think that's where a lot of rock artists are too.
That is super true. I completely agree with that. It's like they're doing things in such an old school way where like your music is your product. That's what you're selling. At a show, you're selling your music. And, you know, it sucks to look at it like that sometimes, but...
just is what it is.
It is what it is, dude. I'm trying to live a good life and eat lots of food and, you know, do shit that I want to do. So, here we are. But, yeah, I can totally see that, where I have such low expenses, no overhead, everything runs in the background, everything's automated, and... I really don't have to do much other than write music to have the band go. Like, I've built like a system. Everything kind of works. I got the robots doing all the heavy lifting instead of, you know, people, because that's, I'm a small artist. You know, it's just me here. But if I had a bunch of staff, I would not have nearly enough money to pay for all that stuff.
Well, you just got to run it like a business.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about like the social media stuff. What I love about the way you approach a lot of your content, some of it is pretty polished, like some of the music videos and stuff, but a lot of it is like real shitty too.
Yeah.
In a great way.
Yeah.
And I love that you are not, that you understand that production values don't mean shit.
I didn't always understand that. It took me a long time. I remember watching YouTube videos and be like, this looks like it was shot on a phone. What the fuck, dude? Like, I could do a better job. Yeah, I could. And then I just stopped for a second and I was like, oh, it's still funny.
Yeah.
It's still enjoyable to watch. It's a delivery system that's working. So why am I hating on it? And then once I fully embraced that, started making like some of my favorite shit. Like some of my favorite music videos are ones that like we went out with a... you know, if old shitty camera and fucked around, or like didn't take more than 10 minutes to make. You know, like one of my videos, I just stood in front of a green screen, or like acted in front of a green screen for 15 minutes and that was it.
That one was great.
Yeah, it's like one of my favorite videos.
Or like one thing you did that it was so simple, but it just really works. I forget which album it is because there's so many of them, I can't keep them all straight. But for the YouTube versions of some of the songs, it was just a loop of you sitting on your front porch.
Yeah, that's a... Taco.
And it's just a simple little thing that just gives a little bit more personality than just, you know, the album art in the middle of the frame. But, you know, it didn't take you that long to do. It's just like there's always that little creative twist that makes it, like the way I've been talking about lately is like just better than the default.
Yeah.
You know, if the default is putting the album art in the middle of the frame, you don't have to like make the best thing that was ever made. You just have to make something that's a little bit better than the default.
Well, and I just get so bored of it.
Yeah, because it's just that's the default. Everyone's seen it before and we're all like inundated with media. And like even if it's free, people don't understand that even free content, you're still asking for something from the world. You're asking for people's attention, which is if anything, like you're asking for people's time, which is the most limited, scarce resource of all.
True.
So the fact that it's free, like that doesn't really mean shit, you know? So what are you offering with this free content you're putting out into the world that is going to make someone say, this is worth me spending a few minutes of my life on it, which I'll never get back?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's partly that and partly just I get bored of the other stuff and I have fun making those videos, you know, like
totally. And you can tell, yeah. I don't understand why people think of that part as like a chore. Or, I mean, I guess I understand maybe not everyone likes that part, but I kind of feel like you need to, like if you don't enjoy the promotion part too, and this is true of whether you are, you know, a visual artist or a sculptor or whatever the fuck you do. Like if you don't enjoy the promotional part, I think these days you're really going to struggle because that's like half the job.
Yeah. It is a large portion of what you do. And it does take time to get comfortable with that. You know, it took me a long time to be like, my music's fucking dope. You should listen to it.
Like, yeah,
you know, but I believe it. So it, you know, it's easier to say it, but the first time you say it, yeah, like I really think that this is awesome and you should listen to it. Felt weird. But I mean, that's truly what promoting music is.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I guess you sort of do that, but I don't get that sense from your content because I do feel like I don't feel like you're selling me. I feel like you're just sort of having fun on the internet, and if other people want to watch, that's cool. But I don't feel like, you know, you're doing the punishing, like, listen to my band, listen to my band, listen to my band, listen to my band kind of thing that just like makes me want to put a bullet in my head.
Well, that's like the opposite of what you should be doing, because what gets people to listen to your band is making stuff that's enjoyable for them to consume and not asking anything in return.
It's true. And I don't know why that's such a hard thing for so many bands to understand. And I feel like it's just part of the culture of, you know, getting back to rap, I feel like rappers just look at it as entertainment and rock bands don't. And I don't really understand why.
Me either. I mean, I do think it'll change, you know, or it's like adapt or die kind of thing. But yeah, there is a very purity to it on my end where I'm like, I like making dumb shit that makes people laugh. That's one of my, you know, I love entertaining people. I love doing it. I like getting laughs and all that stuff. So music videos are such a great way to do that. Or if I can throw something in that makes someone smile or whatever, like is very enjoyable to me.
Another piece of content that you put out, which I think I talked about in a video, I don't remember, if not, I should, is your studio tour that you did, I don't know, 2 years ago or whatever. And what I loved about it is like, I mean, I think your music is very, very well done. Your studio was not fancy. I know a lot of people with way, 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 way nicer setups than you have, but their music doesn't sound as good as yours. And I love the fact that you were like, hey, I have this kind of older computer and a cheap microphone, and this is all I use to make what I do. You don't need anything fancy.
Yeah. And so it was always so funny when I was recording bands, they would come to the studio and be like, you could just see it on their face. Like, oh, so this is it, huh? I'm like, yeah, my dude. It's like, where's the drummer set up? Like, there is no drummer set up. We're just MIDI-ing that shit.
Like, well, going back to our mutual friend Joey Sturgis, I mean, when he was making all those records that blew him and all those bands up, that place was a shithole.
Dude, I mean, we recorded in a garage with no bathroom.
Yeah.
We lived in it. Yeah. Like, it was a shithole, but it was a fun shithole. We had a lot of fun.
And he made a lot of fucking amazing records there.
Dude, yeah. I mean, when we had gotten there, he had just moved out of the garage. And he got a house because he had a couple records that did really well before then. But, like, we were living in that shit for a month, dude. Yeah, it was not nice by any means. And he was, I mean, he truly changed everything because he showed me that you didn't need the greatest stuff to make a record. And I was like, damn, dude, I can do this. Or at least I can get enough gear to be able to potentially like make something good like this, dude. Because I mean, before we went in and recorded with him, all of my favorite records were his, every single one. It's like, what's your five favorite records? It's like all the ones Joey did this year.
Yeah.
Like when we got signed, there was no question who we wanted to go to. It's like, Joey, absolutely. There's no other even consideration. So yeah, I mean, like being able to, I mean, I just worked with what I had. I didn't have a bunch of money to make a dope studio. I'm sure maybe I would have, but I'm glad I didn't because I was able to make something unique with what I was given.
And do you really think that your records would have been any better if you used a U87 instead of whatever that Audio Technica thing or whatever you have is?
No.
It wouldn't have been even 1% better.
Yeah. And I remember like the first 2 years of me producing, it was one of the most frustrating times. I remember those first 2 years, I didn't make a single thing I liked. And I didn't know why it sucked, which is the most frustrating thing. I was like, this sucks, and I couldn't
even
tell you
why. You
want
to know why? Look in the mirror.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was the thing that I needed to realize was like, oh man, if I had this drum pack or if I had this thing, I'd be okay. But I read this book on recording, and it was like, no. You can make good stuff with only stock plugins. And I finally, once I came to that realization, I got way better, way faster.
Well, I keep harping on this because it's just a thing that I keep hearing from so many people. And I've done it too. Like, oh, well, I'm going to start my YouTube channel as soon as I can afford this camera. Or I'm going to start my podcast as soon as I can hire someone to edit it. Or like, it's always like, well, I'll start as soon as I have X, whatever that thing is. And the reason I harp on it is because I love what you said, is you just make the most of whatever you have. And the funny part is that like almost always you have everything you need to make something really good. Like I've told these stories before, but probably people listening to this haven't heard them. Like the two times with music I really realized that was true is I was recording my stupid joke death metal band years ago. And I didn't really like the way the guitar sounded. I was using some amp sim, and I thought it was because of that. And so I had a friend of mine reamp them using the tone from a Motionless and White record with ridiculously amazing guitar tone on it. And it came back sounding like absolute shit, like worse than the amp sim I was using. And I was like, what? Like, what? That wasn't supposed to happen.
There's no excuse. Yeah.
I was like, oh, shit. And then another time, I did a class in Creative Live with Andrew Wade, who's produced a bunch of bands like A Day to Remember and The Ghost Inside and Wage War and stuff. Awesome producer. And he had to record a really quick snippet of something for the class because he was like, oh, shit, I forgot to record this thing. And I was like, well, you can use my guitar and my computer, but it doesn't sound very good. And he's like, well, whatever, I'll make the most of it. And it sounded like 10 times better than anything I had ever done.
Yeah.
And he did it in like 10 minutes. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah. I remember I realized that when I was producing. I was like, there's certain guitarists that are so much easier to dial in a tone for. I'm like, oh, it's because they're fucking dope guitarists and they know how to play.
There's certain
like,
hands that are easier to dial tones in for.
Exactly.
That's what it comes down
like,
to.
You can give John Mayer $30 guitar and he's gonna make it sound amazing.
It'll sound
but
great.
you can give someone who sucks a guitar a $3,000 guitar and it's not gonna sound good.
By the way, I should say, one of the very like heaviest live guitar sounds I've ever heard. I went to the Attack release show at the Newport in...
You were there?
Yeah. I think that was 2011 Dude. Or 10. Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounded fucking amazing. And I remember looking at your guitar being like, that doesn't look like a very nice guitar, but it sounds fucking amazing.
It was like a mid-range Schecter.
It sounded incredible. So that's a great example of it. That's when I first, that's when the pieces started turning for me. I actually was like, Johnny's guitar sounds amazing and it's not that nice.
Dude, well, I will say we had like a boss sound dude. Like, unbelievable. I mean, I'm a decent guitarist. I can make it sound good, but he's an amazing sound guy too. So,
well, he gets then the two of you guys get some credit because it sounded fucking awesome.
Dude, that's hilarious. You were at that show.
Yeah, of course. I believe that's when I met Chase Clymer.
Oh my God. That's great. Chase is a boss. But yeah, dude, that's so funny.
Or, you know, another example, my old boss at Creative Live is a pretty well-known photographer. His name's Chase Jarvis. If people are into photography, they probably know who he is. And he has, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of gear. As I always tell people, you can give him my iPhone. I'll take his $50,000 Hasselblad. Guess who's going to take a better picture?
Yep.
So if you're listening and you're thinking you need to wait until you get some piece of gear or anything like that, you don't. You just need to start and you'll get better.
Yeah. One of the interesting things too is I've been using, I purposefully use cheap gear for Bill Murray Live. I use a $100 guitar. Our bassist's bass is like $300. But in my opinion, I think we sound incredible, you know, because we're tight. We play together well. Everyone knows their parts. I mean, our stuff sounds good, but it doesn't cost a ton of money. I mean, it's like you don't need Axe FX to get a good sound. You don't need a $2,000 guitar.
In fact, it doesn't even help. I wish it did.
No.
I also borrowed an Axe FX from Fractal Audio. Again, thinking like, okay, finally, this is going to be it. Sounded exactly the fucking same as it did before. I wish you could buy talent.
Yeah.
Just doesn't work that way.
No.
It doesn't matter at all. So just give up. If that's your plan, is to buy your way into quality, it does not work that way.
Yeah. And I mean, dude, it's like sometimes it's just fun to make music, even if it's not like great. You can make it and laugh at it later when you're older, you know. Like I always tell people, just make as much stuff as you can, whatever the quality, because when you're 50 and you're listening to some like death metal album you made when you're 15, you're gonna think that's hilarious and you're gonna love it and cherish it.
And you know, I think these days people might actually like rough, unpolished, quote unquote, like low quality content more in a lot of situations because it feels real and authentic. For example, like Instagram stuff, like if it's some like beautifully shot DSLR picture that's been edited and all that stuff, like I can look at it and I'm like, oh, that's a really nice photo. It just feels contrived to me. Whereas like I've mentioned it before, but like the rapper Shinigami, like I don't know what kind of phone he has, but it's a piece of shit because the stuff he posts on Instagram looks terrible. It looks like it's like an iPhone 4 or something like that, but it works because it just feels so real. It's like him standing in his room playing like Game Boy Advance or something shot on an iPhone 4, and it's way better than if it was on a DSLR.
Dude, well, like, I mean, you look at memes themselves and like the ones that look shittier, I like more.
They're better. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't know why, but like,
because it feels real and like raw and authentic. It's the same reason I like a lot of the old like MySpace deathcore stuff better. It sounds like dog shit, but it sounds like a bunch of kids in their basement making something that they were stoked on. And then those same bands years later go to some, you know, big name producer with a bigger budget. And it's like, yeah, this is boring now.
Yeah. I kind of like the basement stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And, you know, I don't think people should like deliberately make things shitty, but on the other hand, like just make whatever you make. Like you said, I think just the answer is just making as much stuff as you can, and that's how you'll find what's right for you.
It's so funny, like sometimes the technically wrong decision is the right decision, especially because you want to always be challenging the listener on what they think is going to happen.
Yes.
I love albums where I'm like, I don't know what the next part is going to be. I hate when I listen to a song and I'm like, all right, I hear the first 3 seconds. I'm like, I know exactly what their whole song's going to be. But like you listen to a Dance Gavin Dance song and you're like, I don't know what the next part is going to be.
I don't know if they know.
Like, yeah, which is awesome. So it's like, I really enjoy music like that. But the wrong, you know, there's a part in this next album where there's a breakdown at the end. And instead of like re-recording it, I just used the demo MP3 of the breakdown and just put it at the end and then added this sub drop that like distorted the entire mix and you can't hear anything other than the sub drop. I'm like, this to me is way more, it's technically wrong in every single way, but it's way more interesting to listen to than if I were to do everything like quote unquote legit.
Totally. And that's what I loved again about that MySpace deathcore stuff. I remember, I think it was like Demolisher, one of those bands, they would have like a sub drop on the one of every measure.
Yes.
And I was like, this is amazing. I love this.
You're like, this shouldn't be right.
The
but
best
it
thing
feels
ever.
So good. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that there's like a certain rebellion to it that I like.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I'm not going to play by the rules. I'm just going to do what I like to do, which makes you stand out.
It totally does. And again, I mean, getting back to what we were talking about before, for I think for a lot of people, there's a huge number of people that just never even get started because they're afraid. You know, they're afraid that they don't know how to do it the right way. And I almost like that's frustrating to me because I want them to do it the wrong way because they're probably going to make something cool.
Yeah, dude. I mean, I'm always encouraging people to make stuff. You never know what's going to happen. And worst case scenario, you make something that sucks that you laugh at later in life. But I do think as I've thought about it more, the biggest impediment to people making stuff and doing what they want is just fear. It's like, I'm afraid I'm going to make something bad. I'm afraid people are going to judge me. I'm afraid of standing in front of a crowd. And like all those things, I mean, I've experienced all those things. I'm afraid of releasing, you know, when I first started, I'm afraid of releasing an album. I did it. It was scary, but you get the benefit. You get over to the other side. And I think the more you can do stuff that is scary to you, the more you'll be in a place that no one else is. Because every time you make that decision of, oh, I'm going to do this thing, even though it's scary, there's hundreds of people that stopped then,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so like that, I do think fear is the biggest like inhibitor of creativity and getting to where you want to be.
Cool. Well, I've taken up enough of your time, and I think that's a good note to end things. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I'm excited we got a chance to chat.
Yeah, man. I feel like we're kindred spirits.
I agree. I can feel the telepathic connection through Skype here.
Same, man.
So I appreciate it. And Rich Sips comes out when? It might be out by the time this podcast is released.
December 17th, so next Wednesday.
Okay, so it will be out by then. So if you're listening to this, go check out the Bill Murray, that's B-I-L-M-U-R-I, Bill Murray album Rich Sips on Spotify or wherever else you consume music.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, I will see you if you ever make it out to Seattle or if I ever make it out to Columbus again.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are the Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.